but I really wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing the creative writing. I wrote so much poetry when I was younger. I'd stopped doing that for years. And so I think this stuff really gave me like permission to find that inner child again and to like embrace it and just let it out. And that has been such a gift.
Welcome to Chasing Leviathan. I'm here with Kelly Shoker. Kelly Shoker is awesome. We met in a writer's group, and I've always appreciated her friendship. She's always been incredibly kind and generous. She's a writer, filmmaker, and former U.S. diplomat. She is represented by the World Arts Agency, and she writes fiction under the pen name Charlotte Dune, which I have to confess, that's how I knew her for the longest time. I just recently, when I asked her to be on the show, found out that her real name is Kelly Shoker. This year, she published a romance adventure book called Cactus Friends, a psychedelic love story, and a poetry and photo chapbook on her emotional responses to the coronavirus pandemic called 10 Stages of a Pandemic. Both books are available on Amazon, and audiobook versions will be available soon on Audible. Her personal essays and interviews have been published in online and in print magazines, including POV Magazine and In the Temper Magazine. Her memoir, Kampala, Sunsets, about her time living among the 1% in Uganda, is with her literary agent seeking publication. She describes the memoir as The Last King of Scotland Meets Boogie Nights. Charlotte Dune's next fiction novel, Mushroom Honeymoon, is slated to come out in December 2020. And I really think, I'll let her explain a little bit more, but I really think that she is a great person to talk about our topic today, which is what do drugs provide in terms of spiritual benefits? What do drugs provide for us in besides just feeling good in terms of making us better human beings? So, Kelly, I almost called you Charlotte again.
I go by both.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Oh, obviously, right? It's all over your books. Kelly, thank you for coming. Really appreciate having you.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about this topic as it's also really influenced my own spiritual life and my writing.
Very much so. When you talk about Cactus Friends and then Mushroom Honeymoon, I mean, Unless that's like that last one is like a chef movie, Mushroom Honeymoon kind of has obvious overtones. So, yeah, very much so. So awesome. Kelly, do you mind just sharing a little bit about yourself? Give us some context for who you are and how you have come to understand, you know, I mean, we call them drugs, but even in the brief exchanges we've had in our messages, like, the terminology there is kind of all encompassing, you know, taking something from marijuana to heroin and putting them under the same umbrella. Is that really useful? So, but yeah, if you could just give us a little bit about yourself, where you come from and your own journey with this topic, that'd be great.
Yes. And I always like to say, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a writer who likes to experiment.
This is not us giving medical advice. If nope. you're going to do anything with this, talk to someone who's an expert. Yes. Like a doctor or something like that.
No medical advice, no legal advice, no endorsement of illegal activities. But, yeah. And I don't like, yeah, as you said, I don't like the word drug. I prefer to use the term entheogens, which actually means, you know, a substance that connects you to a higher power, connects you to God, causes a spiritual awakening. And, you know, I can reserve the term drugs for pharmaceuticals, chemical compounds. But when I'm talking about these kind of medicinal plants and also chemical compounds that trigger spiritual experiences, I don't even like to use the word psychedelic that often anymore, even though I did use it in the title of my book, just because people know it. But I am more and more starting to use the term like I said, entheogens or entheogenic compounds, entheogenic substances, because I do think these spiritual experience inducing substances deserve a category all of their own, and a category that doesn't have like the Timothy Leary kind of tune in, tune out 1970s baggage that the word psychedelics has.
That would be like LSD, correct? When we're talking about psychedelics.
Yeah. Or I think, you know, even when people hear mushrooms, they might think the same thing, but definitely in terms of LSD. And so, yeah, I also consider myself in recovery, which is kind of hard for people to understand. They're like, how can you be in recovery and also kind of experiment with entheogens or talk about entheogens or write about entheogens? And again, it's this distinction of like, these entheogenic compounds are not addictive, and I'm in recovery from things that are addictive, in my case, alcohol and cocaine. So I like to make these distinctions, and I also run a group that is specifically focused on people in recovery that want to use alternative methods, including entheogens and including some other things that you don't normally typically think about in the recovery world, but they want to experiment with them or try them. Things like yoga, mindfulness, sweat lodges, all these kind of, I call it recovery woo-woo, but it's a group of people that want to kind of have a spiritual angle to their recovery from addiction, but who are not into the more rigid AA structure where it's a more Christian focus or God focus. And so I think this is an emerging area. Like, you would be surprised how many people are interested in this. I think also, like you said, we're going through a time period in history where the world is so complex. Politics are so chaotic and everything is moving so fast. We're kind of inundated with data and news and images, and people feel so little control over their external world that they want to kind of go inward and have these experiences where they can try and gain some control over their internal states through kind of seeking a higher spiritual experience, or in some cases, like a negative spiritual experience, because all of these experiences that people have are not always what you would call positive. Some of it is, you know, some of the experiences are difficult and take you back to difficult time periods, but the goal is kind of always moving towards self-discovery or moving towards having these spiritual experiences. And sorry, I didn't say that much about myself and I just jumped right into this.
No, this is fine.
This is an area that really interests me. And it's an area that I tried. The book that I published this year, the novel Cactus Friends, A Psychedelic Love Story, I describe that book as like a spiritual download that came, it's not a religious book, but it was like a total download that came to me during one of these entheogenic ceremonies. Basically, the whole book was just like laid out in my mind. And so I think, you know, these experiences can boost our creativity. They can move us in new directions. And so I enjoy sharing them with other people, and I enjoy sharing my knowledge about it with other people. Though I wouldn't say I'm not an expert in the field of entheogens. Like I said, I'm not a scientist, but I am somebody who's really done a lot of research on them, especially in terms of their ability to help people with depression, PTSD, and drug addiction, as well as just, you know, giving healthy people kind of leveling up their creativity or being more of like a nootropic, something to help their performance. So that's my interest in this topic, I would say.
For sure. Forgive me. What does nootropic mean?
Nootropic is a class of, well, it's a word that people use to describe substances or practices that would kind of enhance your mental capacity or your productivity, your capacity for productivity or your capacity to remember things, kind of like sharpen your intellectual skills. So that may not necessarily be while you're on the substance, but it could be like the long-term effects, or it could be while you're ingesting the subjects. For example, in the case of like some people will describe like Ritalin as a nootropic because it will help with your concentration. Interestingly enough, when they first started researching LSD, they were researching it at far lower dosages. And before that research was made illegal, they were actually using it to treat ADHD with a really great results. So
really,
yeah. And so, I think Michael Pollan writes about that in his book, How to Change Your Mind. But that like, if it hadn't been for kind of these counterculture and like the stigmatization of LSD, that we might all be microdosing our kids with LSD instead of giving them Ritalin. Because yeah. The results were looking really promising. And I've heard similar anecdotal reports of people microdosing mescaline either in Wachuma or peyote to increase their focus and attention. And then I think we've all heard a lot of, or anybody that is kind of interested in this has heard a lot about people in Silicon Valley, you know, coders or engineers microdosing mushrooms or microdosing LSD in order to kind of give themselves an edge in the workplace. And, you know, we don't know, is it really giving them an edge, or is it a placebo effect? We don't really know, but anecdotal evidence seems to be positive. And now they are allowing more legal studies to kind of test these theories. John Hopkins is doing studies, MAPS, a bunch of people now have gotten the rights to be able to study these entheogens and their effects on people's spirituality and performance and what they call the big five personality traits.
Gotcha. So just to clarify for our listeners, I mean, I'm coming at this from a complete novice standpoint. I don't really have a opinion on it. I don't know a lot about it, to be honest. When you're talking about entheogenic compounds, can you give us some names that kind of go with that versus, you know, so we have entheogenic, we have pharmaceuticals, and you kind of created a little bit of a dichotomy there, and even possibly between that and psychedelics. What kind of substances are we talking about? Again, not saying that you're recommending any of these, but, you know, just to understand, like, you know, I hear entheogenic compounds and I hear spiritual awakening, and I don't know what is doing that for. Like, I've heard you mentioned mushrooms, but is there anything else?
Okay, so I would say the most common ones, and I'm sure as time will go on that we'll discover even more because new ones are being invented and discovered all the time. But I'd say the most common ones are the ones that people are most familiar with or used would be psilocybin, which is the mushrooms, LSD, ayahuasca, which is a combination of two plants found in the Amazon. There's another plant called ibogaine that is taken that is said to induce spiritual experiences. And we have Bufo alvarius, which is it comes from a toad's venom. We have just DMT, which people smoke, but it's derived from plants. And I'm like, I'm sure there's more that I'm missing, but those are the ones that come to my, oh, and peyote and Wachuma with the San Pedro cactus and Peruvian torch. Those are kind of in the mescaline family. And those have been used for, you know, decades in Native American religious ceremonies.
Oh, would you say decades? I thought it went stretched back further. I could be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, it does. Yeah, I should say centuries. Thank you for that correction. Some are more recent, though. Like the Bufo alvarius is one of the more recent entheogens that was discovered. I think it was, you know, they put its discovery that you could actually smoke it sometime in the 60s, but then Westerners didn't really find out about it until the mid 80s. And even then, not so much. So it's really only coming into popularity in like the last decade.
Gotcha. Yeah. One of the few things I have seen were, and this is part of the reason I wanted to talk to you about this, was I saw a documentary about shamans taking people through a religious ceremony, I believe in Peru, where they ingested, and I don't remember if it was mescaline or I'm sure it was some kind of variant, you know, something along those lines. And I was struck by how different it was from the American conception of drugs, having like a spiritual leader there to care for you and watch you and guide you through the experience versus like a lot of times it's a very private thing in America, if that makes sense. And so, and they'd been talking like that they'd had this practice for as long as it had been documented, if that made sense.
Yes, definitely. It was probably either ayahuasca or Wachuma. Those are the common entheogenic and traditional plant medicine ceremonies that they would have in Peru. I should also add, you know, a lot of people believe that MDMA and ketamine fall into this category if they're used in a setting that is inducive to inward reflection versus, you know, using it recreationally at a party or something. But that, you know, if you're actually to take MAPS, which is an organization that studies psychedelics, you know, they've done studies where they blindfolded people. No, I shouldn't say blindfold, put us, you know, an eye mask, like a relaxing eye mask, and had people monitored with music and gave them MDMA, which you don't think of a drug that you would take like laying down, and kind of monitored them. And those folks had spiritual experiences at times as well. So I think it's really focused on these plants and compounds that you're using to kind of travel inward, into like a deeper meditation, not necessarily to kind of have an outward or external experience. Although there are religious groups in the United States that come from Brazil who do use ayahuasca in more of a external way where there's singing and group dancing. But a lot of times these practices are more about like laying down, or sitting up, but staying still and really like trying to travel into your inner mind or like your inner dimensions to kind of explore that realm. And that's when people say that, or that's when people cite these religious experiences. Or I think they did a study at Johns Hopkins, and that was in, I think, 2006. And they gave people psilocybin mushrooms. And 2/3 of the participants said it was the most spiritual experience of their entire lives.
I think I saw something about that, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. As I did a little bit of research on this. Yeah, that's that whole, I think it was like top five, like most powerful experience of their life. You know, it's like right up there with like having a kid.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy. Really cool. You know, it's funny how you mentioned the perception. We talk about like the perception of drugs, of, you know, entheogenic compounds, things like LSD, which, you know, even as you're talking about dosing and microdosing, I mean, we're just talking about dosing in general, like mm-hmm. that when they first started out, the dose for LSD was the dose used for treating ADHD. And then it changed to the dosing, you know, the common dosing was for psychedelic experiences, and that's what kind of changed things, if that makes sense. And that's really like something people don't often think about is how, I mean, most things are poisonous depending on the dosage, and many things are really helpful depending on how you how much of it you take.
Yes,
right. That's how chemistry works.
Yeah. And even I was reading recently that, you know, there's some tribes in the Amazon that take tobacco, certain type of tobacco, in such high doses that they have a hallucinogenic experience from the tobacco. But we don't ever think of tobacco as being something that would be hallucinogenic. So it does really depend. There's another scientist working in the United States, especially working on studying mushrooms, and not just psychedelic mushrooms, but all types of mushrooms. His name is Paul Stamets, and he feels very positive about in the future developing treatments that combine mushrooms with niacin in order to kind of cap the dosage, because the niacin will cause like a flush and like a bad reaction if you take too much of it. So he's like, you know, we can give people this medicine in a way that they won't be able to abuse it if it's kind of mixed with this other thing that's going to prevent them from kind of taking more than what we would prescribe for a microdose. So he's been doing research in that area. But I think there's also like tremendous value to kind of having these like big experiences too. So it just depends. Like different people will benefit from a microdose, like on an ongoing basis. And there's different protocols for that. Like some, you know, recommend certain number of days or waiting a certain number of days in between. But then there's also value to having these higher dosages where you have, these intense experiences, and
very helpful. The something I just want to come back to, are you, from what you understand, then all those compounds you're talking about, they're not addicting? Because I think this is where like the overarching just drug term becomes unhelpful, is mm-hmm. that everyone just assumes that all drugs are addictive. If you understand my question.
Yeah. People do not seem to be able to prove that these entheogens are addictive. Maybe the ones on the edge of that would be MDMA and ketamine. But as far as like psilocybin or ayahuasca, I don't think that they've found any conclusive evidence that anyone is getting addicted to these, especially in the case of ayahuasca. Like the physical effects of it are pretty unpleasant. You know, and you do build up a tolerance to them if you do it kind of too much. So it'll completely defeat the purpose. So you won't be able to get the effect that you're looking for, which some people might think, oh, well, wouldn't that cause it to become addictive? But it's not the way your tolerance might build up for like alcohol, where, yeah, if you do drink more, you'll get the same effect. You just like will reduce your effect overall if you keep using this stuff on a regular basis. So I think that also, I don't know, I just have never heard of anybody getting addicted to mushrooms or ayahuasca. And I think something like Bufo too, like it's so in such limited quantities, it's kind of difficult to produce. The effects are, I don't know, it just doesn't seem like something that would be habit forming. And I don't think that they've found any evidence scientifically from these studies that it is habit forming. So I think it's pretty safe. I would say it's safer than alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol, that's definitely one of those. It's amazing to me, you know, growing up, the way it was presented to me, it came from a very conservative household. And of course I grew up right in the middle of the DARE campaign. So right. It was just like everything is bad. And then alcohol kind of has its, and even smoking at that time had its own like niche, you know, mm-hmm. they had their own niches because it's just culturally accepted. And, I think that's where like even naming these things differently is really helpful. I mean, that's one of the big driving forces with marijuana, is that people are like, how is this worse than alcohol? Like, I mean, it really seems to be better than alcohol in most cases.
Yeah, we just can't put marijuana in the same category as heroin. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And I guess I should say that, you know, this is all, when I talk about this being safe, it's all in the understanding that you have, that you're actually taking the substance that you think you're taking, that you're in a safe environment, that you have, you know, people kind of looking out for you, and that you don't have any like pre-existing mental health conditions like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, and that you also are not taking any medication that impacts your mental state. So it is dangerous to mix some of these compounds with especially antidepressants, so SSRI.
I would imagine so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you have to be very careful about drug interactions, which is another reason I wish they would just, decriminalize everything and do studies and put out information so people could know, what's safe and what's not. But luckily we have the internet and so many people have tried, and so many like kind of rogue chemists have done their own experiments, and there is a lot of information that you can look up about drug interactions. When MAPS puts out like a whole drug interaction table that goes through almost like every single drug or category of drugs and matches them with other drugs to show you like the levels of danger for that interaction, from like no interaction to potential death. So that is one thing people have to be really concerned about if they're seeking out these kind of experiences, or to, go and do this in a country where it is legal, or where they have ceremonial spaces that have been reviewed, that have, people have said are safe and good environments. It's becoming more popular, and anything that becomes more popular kind of becomes more accessible. So people also just have to worry about, where is it coming from? If they're getting it, is it coming off like the dark net? And if it is, are they really getting what they're saying that they're getting? And there's organizations that offer like testing kits too, where you can test if you were to try and do some of this on your own, you could test it before you did it. And this kind of stuff, like Dance, there's a group called Dance Safe that you can order tests for if you want to test your own materials to make sure of what they are.
Well, depending on, what the audience for this becomes, the odds of someone struggling with opioid addiction is pretty high, considering, how our country's been dealing with that. And from what I understand, you'd put opioids under pharmaceuticals, correct?
For sure. And like addictive, addictive, yep, harmful, detrimental pharmaceuticals. I mean, they just settled that case with the opioid manufacturer that they're going to have to pay a huge settlement. But I think it's like, I forget the exact amount, but even though it was billions of dollars in settlement money, they still made like $30 billion off the opioids. So
yeah, no, they don't even care. Like for them, it was just the cost of doing business, which is, that's a whole nother discussion about corporate America. But, I mentioned it is, how has, one, it's fentanyl has become a huge problem. Mm-hmm. I'd never even heard of it, until a couple of years ago with the opioid, epidemic. You have people, cutting, what people think they're buying. And so if we have someone like, get help if you're struggling with that. But also, it's good to know that there are things to test, because the overdosage for fentanyl is extremely, is way more than a lot of the other opioids.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, one of these entheogens in particular has shown kind of astounding and amazing positive results in terms of treating opioid addiction.
Oh,
and
really?
That's ibogaine, which comes from a plant in Central Africa and has been used there medicinally, for as long as anybody knows.
Right.
But it's kind of made its way into like a Western clinical setting. And they have ibogaine clinics in Mexico. I think they're legal now in Vancouver, different places, but they're like reporting almost like 100% success rate. Like it's crazy. And,
well, that's phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very intense, you have to do it in a clinic in a medically supervised setting, because detoxing from any drug can, you know, there's, you need to make sure you're like ready and supervised to do it, but, and also like Ibogaine can be quite intense. And you're basically, from my understanding, you like leave your body for a certain period of time. So you're not able to like move or, do anything. So you need to be in a really safe setting, but they've had amazing positive results where people just take it and 2 days later, they are not addicted to opioids. They're not addicted to heroin. They're just like the desire is gone. It's doing something in the brain where it's just like covering over those receptors completely. And I was actually watching a documentary on it pretty recently. And, one of the scientists was talking about why Ibogaine hasn't kind of become more popular or hasn't been put into these, you know, like a pharmaceutical program or like offered as a Western treatment in a lot of places. And he said it's because you can't patent it. So it's a plant and that's all it is. Nothing else gets added. And there's no way to like hold the rights to it. And so people don't want to invest in the necessary FDA trials in order to get it approved to use in rehabilitation centers. And so it hasn't been, and that's why people are, you know, flying to Mexico to go to these clinics, and they can't have it at clinics in the United States. It's because it's just not profitable.
There's a lot of FDA stuff that ends up being a problem like that.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, whether it's from food or all sorts of different things, where if you can't patent it, people aren't interested in providing all the money to get through the government regulation, even though the production of it would be cheap. Yeah, it's a frustrating thing, and it's a glaring flaw in our system for sure.
Absolutely. And I think they've also shown a lot of promise, at least for alcoholics. And I hear with opioid addicts as well, because I think often both alcoholism and I think often any kind of addiction is going to have a trauma component. And,
right.
Ayahuasca has shown such promising results treating depression and trauma and PTSD, that's the other entheogen that I would say probably has the most promise for people that are looking for these, that have maybe found that their situations are kind of untreatable. Like they've tried everything else. And they don't have, maybe they haven't had success with traditional therapies but they're not like schizophrenic. They're not bipolar. They're not on any kind of like, antidepressant. Then ayahuasca is something I think more and more people are trying and having success with. I think for me personally, I had actually been diagnosed with PTSD at one point in my life. Mm. I had gone through some like traumatic stuff when I was living in Cameroon. We didn't even talk about that part of my life yet, and I found that I later took ayahuasca like years later. Mm-hmm. And I found that it really helped me. Like I used to have, you know, bouts of depression, and I don't know if, you know, I'm sure there's a combination of factors, but I definitely don't think the ayahuasca hurt. Gotcha. And yeah. I would say it had some positive benefits, and yeah, like I said, maybe this is a placebo effect, but it's been so widely reported, and there's been studies that have shown that, you know, it increases people's ability to memorize facts. It increases people's ability to focus and retain information, that it's reduced the amount of kind of depressive episodes people has. It has reduced people's anxiety. So I think more and more people are kind of experimenting with this, and it's becoming more mainstream. You know, there's a couple places in the United States and in Canada that have decriminalized ayahuasca. I mean, there's even an ayahuasca center very close to where you are. I don't know if you've heard about it.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's one of the only, it's the only legal, well, it's in a legal gray area, but I believe it's the only place that's kind of targeting people that have PTSD and depression or addiction that's doing ayahuasca ceremonies in Florida. So that's the SoulQuest Center that's near you. I haven't been, but I think I might go eventually.
Okay.
It's in Orlando. There's a couple of different ayahuasca churches actually operating in Florida. There's the Daime, which is in the Brazilian tradition. And then there's another Brazilian one called the UVD. That is also a church that uses ayahuasca in its sacrament. And all of those have been kind of given permission to operate under religious freedom. So they're considered to be churches, and the ayahuasca is a sacrament for their religious experiences and for their members.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like underage drinking at Catholic churches, right? And, you talk about communion and stuff. I mean, you know, it's similar. Religion gets a pass in those cases.
Yes.
I definitely want to keep going in this direction. This is really fascinating to me. Something that's really interesting about what you've said in terms of risks and in terms of how much care you should show with these entheogenic compounds is people get very nervous and upset about these risks. But then when they hear that long list after antidepressants and pharmaceuticals, it's fine because FDA approved. But the only difference between those two in terms of risk, I mean, when you talk about like potential death, that's something that shows up with antidepressants and pharmaceuticals just in general, it really comes down to what you said about the patents. And that's really the only, like, the risks are the same. And if this is making sense,
I think like in the case of mushrooms, your risks are much lower than even your risks with alcohol.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Like,
yeah.
You can't mushroom yourself to death to the best of my knowledge, but you know, you can definitely drink yourself to death or have all kinds of, you know, negative health precautions. So I would say, I mean, maybe you would argue that like nobody's going to take as many mushrooms as somebody might take alcohol.
Alcohol. Yeah. Well, I mean, I wasn't necessarily speaking about mushrooms, and I don't know a lot of, like, I mean, there are obviously, you know, you mentioned MDMA, ketamine, LSD, these ones obviously like have like serious ramifications. I have heard that of the ones that are out there, mushrooms do tend to be the safer ones. But it's funny how people will take something like LSD or that sort of thing, but then they'll take, and you know, you have potential death, all these things. And if you use it for a long time, it can hurt you. But then when you hear if you ever listen to the laundry list, the one where they like liver disease, or like, you know, you could bleed forever and then you could die. Like, that's like the end of all commercials. And then you're like, people are like, ask your doctor. I'm like, why would I want to put this in my body? And it's like, well, it's FDA approved. And that's literally because of the patents.
Yeah. It's I'm not making money. That's
it really is. Yeah. No, I'm not saying like, I mean, I don't understand all the risks involved. I was just saying, it's funny to me how people are okay with taking incredibly, and that's what we're seeing with the opioid epidemic. And what's frustrating to me is this conversation of like things that are even more natural, but it's completely, the perception is completely off. You have
to say. It's really social programming, and it's really deeply connected to capitalism. It's funny, I was having this conversation with my yoga teacher this very week, at the beginning of the week. And I don't know how the subject of, I remember she told me that she wanted to quit drinking. She felt like alcohol was kind of having a negative impact on her life. And so she was kind of asking me like, how do you manage in social situations without drinking? And we're talking about this. And she was like, well, do you ever do anything? Are you just like completely sober? Like, don't you ever feel like you want to like change your mental state? And I said, well, you know, every now and then I'll take mushrooms. And she just couldn't believe. she just couldn't believe it. She just didn't. I guess she knows me in a capacity that she just didn't think that I would do that. Or she had a lot of preconceived notions about mushrooms and who would take them. She was just really surprised. And so we had a conversation about it. And she was like, I'm so nervous about taking it because I'm afraid I'll lose control or I'll have anxiety. And I was kind of like, well, you just told me that alcohol was making you have anxiety. And like all these the things, whole point yeah. of alcohol is you're feeling out of control kind of. So I told her, I was like, there's no experience that you will have probably if you're in the right set and setting with an entheogen that would be like worse or more debilitating than if you were drinking alcohol or drinking alcohol and doing cocaine. You know, it's, I think people have this fear that comes from this kind of bad. And I even think LSD is a lot safer than people think it is. You know, I think the percentage of people that jump out windows on LSD is probably far less than the percentage of people that pick up guns while they're drinking whiskey and shoot themselves. So I think that, you know, if you have suicidal ideations, you shouldn't be doing any of this. You need some help anyway. That's not this. And it's not this in an unsupervised way.
I think that's the main thing I'm hearing about all of this is like, I mean, what's one of the common wisdoms, what's common wisdom around alcohol? It's like, well, don't drink alone. But because it's so familiar, people just do it. And,
well, not just familiar, but it's so addictive, you know, it's an addictive substance. So people get into the place where they, not everyone, but some people get into the place where they need to drink every night and you're not necessarily going to, or need to drink every day. And you're not necessarily going to find buddies to be able to do that with you. So you're going to end up drinking alone. And then, you know, that has been shown to kind of put people into this because it really disrupts your brain chemistry. You know, it's a neurotoxin and it really disrupts the amount of what they call GABA that's in your brain. And then your brain tries to rebalance. And in this attempt for your brain to rebalance, it really causes anxiety and it causes depression. So then they get into the cycle where in order to get the depression and anxiety to go away, they drink more, but then the next day the anxiety and depression is back even worse. And then you're in this kind of like loop that I think entheogens can sometimes help people get out of that loop too, because it can kind of break that cycle and show them that some other possibility.
Yeah. That's a whole nother, that idea of needing to just see what life looks like outside of your current routine. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just get stuck. I mean, and that's not just for alcohol or drugs or entheogens. I mean, that's just in general in life. Like, I mean, exercise, like people just like, they'd never want to exercise more than a week in a row and just feels terrible. But if you do it for, you know, you stick with it and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, this feels good. Yeah. and that's just human beings have, they love their inertia, you know, they love to just keep going. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I feel the same way about yoga. For years, I would like sporadically do like a yoga class and I'd be like, this is terrible. And then when I finally decided to do like a yoga challenge that kind of forced me to do a lot more classes, you know, after you get like 20 classes or so, you're like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I need to do this every single day. And then it becomes an entheogen itself. But before that, it's kind of just like, I liked the way Michael Pollan explained it. Actually, he said that, you know, our minds are, they become like ski slopes where the paths are just very, kind of embedded into the hill. Like you get these trails that form. And so all your thoughts go down this path and your habits go down these paths that are like these well-trodden trails, and these entheogens, it's like the snow falls again and all the trails get washed over and like recovered, and it's fresh powder, for you to start like finding new pathways down. And new I thought habits. That was yeah. very beautiful and apt metaphor for this.
Oh, and that's really helpful and helps lead me into a question I've been wondering, because I just had this discussion with somebody about mushrooms, and you know, they told me a story like they were, because we start out by talking about how the marijuana debate is going, and they were literally talking to a friend who, it's like, well, let's the friend was like, I don't think marijuana, you know, I think marijuana might be worse than alcohol. It's like, well, let's say it wasn't. Let's say, you know, regardless of the facts, you know, let's just say that, you know, because it doesn't seem like it is, but let's say marijuana and alcohol's positions were reversed. Forgive me. What they said was, marijuana is illegal, so I'm just not going to do it because it's illegal. And my friend asked them, if marijuana was legal and alcohol was illegal, would you do marijuana? And the person was like, no, I just don't think I could. And it's like, what? It's just literally how, like, it's just so wrapped around their brain. Like, it's, they just can't deal with that. But as we continued, my friend and I continued our conversation, we were talking about, mushrooms. And my friend said, it's interesting to me, but I'm too scared that I would have a bad trip. And that's something that you just mentioned when you're talking to your friend who's struggling with alcohol. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned earlier that negative trips can be a good thing. So, I mean, if you, I would love to hear more about how can a negative trip be a good thing, and what does a trip do for you, both during it and afterwards? How are you changed, and how does that help? I mean, obviously, you gave the ski slope analogy, and that's what triggered this question for me. It's really it's a really apt one, helps really clear my mind about it, but I'd love to hear more.
Yeah. Well, I think this idea of the bad trip is also kind of, you know, a throwback to the 70s and kind of the negative stigma around these things. But occasionally people do have bad trips. Like, there's a time and place for everything. So if you try to take these substances in an environment that is inhospitable to their use, or if you take too much, or if maybe you're just going through a really tough personal experience, like your mom just died or something that would cause you to be really upset no matter what, then you do have the potential to kind of have a negative experience. You know, some people feel sick. Some people feel like they want to throw up. Some people do feel anxious, or they might have like a vision that are intrusive thoughts, like something that they can't get out of their head that they don't want to see. Or they might just feel physical sensations that are freaking them out. You know, they might kind of go into like a hypochondriac mode where they think something's more wrong with them than it is. And it's really just like, you know, they're really just getting kind of anxious. And I think oftentimes bad trips are caused by trying to do something in an environment that doesn't make sense for the substance. Like, you know, you're trying to go on like a bike ride or something and somebody gives you mushrooms, unless you're kind of experienced with that, you know, unless you have some experience, you're going to struggle, or like, you know, take something and then realize, I have a friend that tells me this hilarious story about how she like took something and then actually this kind of happened to me when I was in university. I took something and, it was called DXM, which is a psychedelic that I don't know. It seems to not be around anymore. But I took it and I completely forgot that I had a field trip for my French class that I couldn't miss. And so I had to go to the French class and I was trying to speak French. And, you know, it was a bit stressful in the beginning. But even then, I kind of, you know, by the end of it, I would say it was a good trip. I enjoyed the French field trip. But it's those situations where, like, you know, you take LSD and your grandmother happens to come over and you're freaking out.
Oh, my goodness. Like, oh, yeah.
Those are the bad trips. But then there's also the bad trips where, like, you know, let's say you go to an ayahuasca ceremony. You drink the ayahuasca, and some people, it brings up like repressed trauma or things they don't think about, like sexual abuse or childhood neglect. And, you know, they might describe it as like an unpleasant experience to revisit that. They might be like crying. But then at the end of the experience, there's usually something you take away from it. You learn something from remembering the experience. Like you draw new conclusions about it. You might come to peace with it. Just the happiness that the medicine also kind of induces, or these entheogens, they do release serotonin. So even if you're experiencing like or remembering something traumatic, you may now be having that memory with like more positive or loving emotions. Or maybe instead of, you know, blaming yourself for something that happened, you can now see, okay, that happened because like I was just in this situation that was beyond my control. You may gain like new perspective on the event or on your role in the event. And then that leads to self-growth and some peace that you can find within yourself in terms of some of these like past experiences. So I think that's the way. And people talk a lot about shadow work, which I'm kind of like, I don't know how I feel about that term, but you know,
yeah, I have no idea what that is, but sounds exciting. Sounds like something in a fantasy novel. Like, they're shadow workers, you know.
Yeah, right. It's a very new age concept where shadow work is this idea that we all have our shadow selves. It's kind of like the idea of the ego and the id, except
It's a Jungian term.
Yeah, except in the shadow work, it's like we kind of don't know. The idea is that you don't know what your shadows are until you start poking into emotions that you're having. So let's say that you're out with a group of people and someone says something that irritates you. Well, to do shadow work on that, you would sit down and think like, what is it really about this person that irritated me? Like, what is that in me? Is it because I'm jealous? Is it like, so you try to pull out this like hidden aspect of yourself that's causing this reaction, rather than just saying, oh, that person's annoying. It's like, well, why, what is in me that that person is poking?
Hmm. Yeah. Yes.
So psychedelics can make you have these kind of examinations too. Even like post-trip, you know, you might have a trip where things don't go as you planned and, you know, maybe you get upset about something. And then later after the trip is over, you can kind of like go back into that and analyze like, you know, why did that upset me so much? Or, you know, you can kind of investigate or reevaluate the trips. And they're often quite memorable. I mean, it depends. Like sometimes things seem like, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, especially about like DMT, the smoke DMT, have these like incredible visions. And then it's like, they can't describe them afterwards. But for other things, the trips are quite memorable. You can really vividly remember what happened. I mean, there's a trip that I took, like my first mushroom experience. I was, I think, 18. And I can remember that trip like it was, I mean, you know, I have a vivid memory. I could tell you what happened in it, what I saw, like the images. So some of this stuff is so memorable that it allows us to kind of go back and reinvestigate the meaning and think about the meaning in new ways. And yeah.
So, and what we've been talking about so far are bad trips. And it sounds like there are two kinds of bad trips, right? Like it sounds like all these entheogenic compounds are both facilitating and maybe even creating these inward journeys. And so either you're not in a place where you should be making that kind of inward journey, like maybe you have some outward forces like riding a bike that, you know, you shouldn't like.
Going to the dentist. Like,
have you actually, like, is that something you've done or you know someone who's gone to the dentist while on one of these? That sounds horrific.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Not me though. I would never.
Oh my goodness. Oh, I can't. The dentist. I mean, you want to talk about a stressful environment? Oh my goodness, I can't even imagine.
I did have an experience where I went up into the CN Tower. I don't know if you are familiar with the CN Tower.
I've not been there, but yes, it's very tall.
Yep. It's very tall, and you ride up this like kind of terrifying glass elevator. And if the wind is blowing, you can feel the whole elevator, and it's like, I don't know, like 20 or 30 stories. So that experience, I was like, what have I done? Like, why did I choose to do this? But then once I got inside, it was fine. But
Well, yeah. I mean, that freaks.
I wouldn't do that again now. I really take these things very, very, I basically won't take, I don't take these compounds very often. And when I do, it's usually in a state that you would describe as like really meditative. Like I'm planning on being just, you know, in a safe environment outside somewhere, maybe I'm, you know, in on a bed or somewhere comfortable, and I'm just going to kind of close my eyes. And, or in an ayahuasca ceremony, you're laying down in the grass and there's somebody watching over you and the shaman is singing, and it's very kind of religious. I think I really prefer these more religious experiences. I don't kind of wander around the city taking mushrooms anymore, though I do think there's value in that. Like I mean, sometimes I'm like, I like to tell people there's no such thing as a bad trip. Like I think there's value from them, and I think your chances of having a good trip are much higher than your chances of having a bad trip. And right. good and bad, what does it mean anyway? Like, if you're just going to go have an experience, you shouldn't set too many expectations for it.
Well, and that's, you know, the other one is because it seems to create this inward journey, like this heightened awareness of your own emotions, you know, that's kind of what you're describing. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, everyone's terrified when you go up in an elevator and start shaking, right? Like, that's not, you know, that just made the drug or the compound just makes it worse. But when we talk about the other one is if you have something that you have not faced up to inwardly. And that seems to be the other negative trips, you know, whether good or bad. And in some ways, that sounds like it could be a good thing to force you. And this comes from, I have a small degree of background in counseling and having worked through some very difficult things with people. And it's amazing to see the difference between people who are willing to embrace the difficulty and then go on through it versus people who keep getting caught and stuck. Yeah. And I think when you talk about the conversation that surrounds bad trips, it's a lot of times people who start to have be faced with something they've hidden for a long time, they've repressed for a long time, and then they just get stuck and they go back out instead of just facing it and then moving on through. Which is what you have to do with every kind of trauma, is you have to complete the story to the other side, if that makes sense.
Yes, 100%. And I think also the integration afterwards, you know, we talk about psychedelic integration, which is kind of, you know, if it's in a therapeutic environment, you might revisit your experience with a counselor or with a trip sitter, as they call them, like somebody who's role is to kind of talk to you about what happened and to kind of help you make sense, like the way, you know, the way you might like analyze your dreams or analyze some emotion that you're having. Like it's really beneficial. If it's not going to be with a counselor, it's really beneficial to do it with a friend, as long as the friend is, you know, like kind and trustworthy and can hold that space for you. Or like a loved one. Like, I actually think that these entheogens, if people started using them in like a marital counseling kind of way, I think they would have so much benefit. I think they can be really positive for couples, as long as it's done in a safe environment and there's no like domestic abuse involved, or like there's no history of domestic abuse or domestic violence. Like for couples that are just having, you know, kind of PG vanilla run-of-the-mill marital problems, or maybe they've like lost their spark, or they're having some kind of, you know, ideological difference. I think these can also be the tremendous value for couples therapists and couples trying to strengthen the bond that they have together. Because when you have a spiritual experience with someone else, and or you take that time to talk to each other, you know, as the trip is coming down, your mind is kind of open. You know, you can form these new pathways with your relationship and maybe come to some new realizations. And then also there, some of these have shown to have like really positive benefits on your mood for either in the short term or the long term. So you may in your relationship just benefit from the fact that you're less irritable in general after doing the experience, and that like reduction of irritability can last for like a month, 2 months. and then you might kind of need another booster.
Well, I'm not gonna lie. When you said mood, I wasn't sure if that was a euphemism for something. I'm like, oh, she's just talking about in general your mood. You know, it's like it'll help you in the mood. I didn't know.
Although I have heard people say that Bufo can increase people's libido, not while you're on the Bufo, but after. So like post. I've heard that kind of anecdotally about ayahuasca as well, that like, but I think that's just because you can't have, you're not supposed to have sex like before or after ayahuasca ceremonies for kind of like as long as you can. There's this idea of like sexual fasting related to that entheogen, where they're like, don't have orgasms with yourself or others prior to the ceremony, and also for like 2 weeks after. So I think that's people are just super in the mood because they've been fasting.
That sounds more like someone not putting together like what the real causation is there versus like the other one may be the case. Yeah. But that makes total sense. Like if you're getting kind of run down and you are just getting irritable and frustrated, just taking a break and resetting your mood like that could be very helpful. I could see that definitely. I think the big thing, I mean, with all of this is because we're such an individualistic society, everything that you're mentioning, and even what we're talking about with pharmaceuticals and, you know, whatever uses they may have, you want to invite other people into the process in a healthy way. Like that's like just doing this on your own because it is so powerful. All of these things, they're so powerful. It's very dangerous, right? So it seems like it's very important to involve other people, like a trip sitter or, you know, your doctor, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I mean, it varies widely. Like I wouldn't say it's very dangerous to take mushrooms on your own, but it would be dangerous to take Ibogaine by yourself. But yeah, it's great to involve others and to have the community. And like some of the studies on ayahuasca, the scientists are like, well, we don't know if it's the ayahuasca or if it's the fact that these people meet every single month and become all good friends with each other and share their deepest like feelings with each other after the ceremonies. And it's just like this community, then the sense of community that is having such positive benefits, or if it's the ayahuasca itself. You know, there hasn't been enough studies done to like say, but the community can't hurt. Like it's always a good thing to have human connection. And there's, yeah, it kind of, and a lot of people aren't religious. Like I think the most common religion now is none. Like people just don't have one.
Right, right.
So, I think, you know, it is kind of a way for, I see like a lot of young people, like kind of recent high school grads or like young people in California or South Florida, like kind of these more like urban areas where there's a lot of different cultures. I see a lot of young people gravitating towards this and kind of gravitating towards plant medicine as they would like some kind of religion or some kind of community experience. And you see this at like the festival culture too, like the Burning Man culture and this desire for community that's outside of kind of our capitalistic community. Like they really want an alternative. And so this plant medicine community is kind of giving, like I meet more and more young people who don't drink alcohol at all, who don't like kind of take like harsher like pharmaceutical drugs, but they will, you know, go to an ayahuasca ceremony like whenever they can, or they will like occasionally take mushrooms at a concert or something. So I think younger people are kind of like, our generation was just like binge drinking and kind of like that Kirk, you know, like I think you and I are close in age. It was like the DARE era where we just did a lot of heavy drinking. Some people got into like harder drugs. I don't know. I grew up in a rural area, so a lot of people were doing meth. But I think
versus anything we're talking about is like one of the worst things ever. Yeah.
Absolutely terrible. Literally the side effect is psychosis. Like it makes you psychotic. Like that's the bad trip one.
Yeah.
But I think younger people kind of know this, like they have a better sense of it. And so they're, a lot of them are going in a different direction if they can, if they have access to this kind of stuff, like people in Denver. You know, I think it's becoming very widely, like a lot more widely accepted, as like the, you know, kind of hippies that already went through the psychedelic era. They're now like, you know, kind of in going into their retirement age. And I even have some of my parents' friends, that are now retired, and they'll ask me about this stuff. They'll be like, do you think it's safe for me to do this? 'Cause I want to have like an experience. And they're kind of returning to it. That would be like Michael Pollan's generation. And they're also looking for like some kind of spiritual experience, or like they're getting closer to their own deaths. They have a deeper sense of their own mortality, and they're looking for something that can help them make sense of that mortality. And they haven't been actively involved in like a Christian church or in organized religion. So I see a lot of older people like coming back to this.
Yeah. And that makes total sense. And you've said it a couple times, and in some ways, you've even said at times positively of religion, but other times you've kind of talked about how this is spiritual versus religious. Can you explain a little bit of what you think the difference is between those two, and what the kind of polarization you're creating there? Like what are we talking about when we're saying something spiritual and not religious?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, this is always kind of in flux for me. I was raised in a very, like, my parents were not Christian. My mom, they were not like dogmatic Christian, but I grew up in the Bible Belt. So I was completely surrounded by it, by this very conservative, very dogmatic, Protestant and different strands of Christianity, but all like rural Bible Belt Appalachia Christianity. And so that left like a negative experience for me. My mom was from a Jewish family, and so people would say nasty things to me when I was a kid about being Jewish, even though we weren't really practicing Judaism. So I think I had a lot of baggage towards religion, but as the older I get, the more value I see in it, and the more I think it is all just a personal choice. But I think for people like me that have that baggage towards organized religion, just the idea of being spiritual can kind of be something that makes sense, because we still all want that kind of awakening, or that surrender to a higher power, that like accepting, or like universal love. Like we kind of crave that kind of belonging. And if we don't find that in organized religion, then some people can still find it in these like spiritual communities. So I think that's where I kind of lean towards. I mean, even we're talking about AA. I mean, even Bill Wilson, who founded AA, is reported to have gotten the idea while he was on an LSD trip. I mean, some people say that Bill Wilson got it from taking morning glory seeds, because he was part of a study and they had given him morning glory seeds, which is another psychedelic. And others say it was while he was on LSD trip. But I mean, he experimented with all these things, and then he kind of like put them into their Christian mold. And I think, I think that if you're religious, you may have a religious experience. Like it's interesting too, with the, you know, the ayahuasca shamans that I've encountered, a lot of them wear emblems of Jesus. So like I went to an ayahuasca ceremony. And actually, I write about this in Cactus Friends, because Cactus Friends, my book, it takes place at like there's a fictional ayahuasca ceremony in it, but I am inspired by real life. But the shaman was wearing this giant beaded necklace the size of a dinner plate that was the face of Jesus. And, you know, it surprised me when I first saw it. And then they were incorporating, like, saying the Lord's Prayer during the ceremony and, like, praising Jesus and, like, being clear that if people wanted to praise a different God, they could, but, like, he was Christian. And so...
I think
it's also very interesting. And like, especially the Church of the Daime, the Brazilian church, that also does ayahuasca as part of their ceremonies, it really feels like a religion. Like you feel like you're in some kind of mass, like a mass, right? And people are singing hymns. And there is this very interesting mix of like Amazonian indigenous culture with like Western Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah, Christianity has a long history of syncretism in those sorts of ways. And it's really, mm-hmm. I mean, part of that is just because it has become so cultural, which is a lot where a lot of its, you know, corruption can happen, not necessarily talking about the ayahuasca stuff, but like what your early experiences, like we see Christianity adopted for terrible purposes as well. Right. Yeah. Like people love being able to say, well, God told me to be a jerk. Cause then they can justify their behavior.
It's just so, God working in mysterious ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. And that's a very painful thing for just everyone involved. To see that. I consider myself a devout Christian, but it's incredibly painful to see, something that is not in any way encouraged in the Bible. You know, when you talk about that negative experience that you had, I mean, I grew up in a conservative household, and I've had my fair share of, I mean, if you grew up in American Christianity, you've had a negative experience with yeah. American Christianity. Like it's happened at least once, but most of the time, like it's just, you have people who, call themselves Christians for the value it gives them in the community, but it really can, they do it just for the power and not for the actual, what you're talking about here, that awakening, that belonging, that sort of love and surrender. You know, it's really fascinating to see, kind of the benefit, even if we're talking about these compounds, but we mentioned earlier exercise, right? Like there's mm-hmm. a lot of different ways to make this, spiritual journey, to become someone more authentic and more genuine. And I think at the end of the day, we'd like to say everyone's trying to become a better person, but yeah. I think we know some people are trying to become a better person and there's a lot of different ways to try and get there. And then there are some people who are not interested at all and they'd rather be stuck.
Well, and then I think there's people that are trying to become a better person. And then there's some people who are just desperate for an escape hatch. Like their life is miserable and they're just looking for the fastest escape they can find. And, you know, sometimes psychedelics are criticized as being spiritual bypasses. So like a way for people to kind of get to like level 10 Buddhist meditation in like one sitting. So people are like, you shouldn't do that. You should suffer and have a real spiritual experience. But like, I don't like this idea of like a hierarchy of your spirituality is better than mine or your experience is deeper than mine. Like I don't espouse that.
I don't think that's helpful. It's just not a helpful way to think about it. You know, something you said there, I grew up and I obviously, I was a big reader and I would have people tell me, oh, you read just to escape. And I didn't mm-hmm. feel like that at all. And, even as you're talking about these different compounds, I'm sure people do take them just to escape, but, I think even like, this is just an interesting parallel for me. Like I read because I found that I had better access to truth through mm-hmm. certain forms of like, if it was really good fiction, I felt like I was tapping into something that yes. I couldn't otherwise get. How do you feel? I mean, obviously you've written about it, but, you know, I didn't mention it earlier, but you also directed a film. You've done quite a bit else. Obviously, used to be a U.S. Diplomat, which is, you know, it wasn't the point of this interview, but that's fascinating. But how have all these experiences influenced and shaped your art? And how has your art influenced and shaped your experiences with these compounds?
Such a good question. And I just want to first go back to your reading comment, because I often say that reading is an entheogen, because I think reading and reading good books can have such a dramatic, powerful impact and such a way to improve our lives, and can also connect you to those spiritual truths. So I think I'm right there with you on that. Like, read as much as you can. But as far
as read good books, yeah,
read good books.
The difference.
Read good books. Follow your heart as to what knowledge you seek out. But I think reading can be so powerful to change our minds too. Like, it is also a way to give us new ideas and to expand our minds. And I worry that it's becoming a lost art, but then again, I don't think so. Like, book sales are up and it's good. And we have audiobooks now, which is great.
We are in a pandemic, so I think that might be a temporary thing, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Maybe it'll stick.
But as far as my art, I think it really helps me to just lift me out of the depression that I was in, because I had really been in quite a lengthy depression. And so just to lift me out of that and kind of help me just be more productive and to actually finish writing the books that I had started. And so just on that level, that basic level of just helping me to kind of find new paths in my own life. But I think also to just helping me accept myself, and because I think I had a lot of insecurities. So I was very insecure, I had negative self-talk, nobody's going to want to read these books. Why am I even writing? This is dumb. And I think it just helped me accept myself and be no, this is what I like. And it's really fun. And I think people are going to like it, and I'm just going to do it because I love doing it. And it kind of helped me just have permission to kind of play with things and not take myself so seriously. And because, I had worked for the government for a long time. And so, I worked for the State Department from the time that I was 24 until the time that I was 35, I want to say. And so I'd really been programmed to kind of be working in this really rigid environment, following all these rules, constant paranoia of what others were thinking about me, because I had to put on, I was in a very public relations role where I had to put on I was always representing the US government. I had to, I couldn't have
been. No pressure,
right? Had to maintain my security clearance. I couldn't be experimenting with any of this kind of stuff until after I left the department. And I didn't do any of this stuff with entheogens while I was in the department. But I think just helping me reset my life, because when I left, I was kind of in a place where I was what is next for me? I knew I didn't want to keep working for the government. I knew I needed something more creative. I was kind of dying from being inside this government box. And the first thing I did was make that film. And that kind of happened just by happenstance, almost kind of fell into it. But then I was my true love has always been writing. My mom says I wrote my first book when I was in fourth grade, which of course she kept. And
thanks, mom.
I'm so glad she did. She's such a sweetheart. But I wrote so much, and then kind of I got into college and I was you can't be an artist. You can't do this. You need to find a good job that pays well and that's respectable. People will look, that will make your parents and grandparents proud. And I just stopped writing for so long, except for formal reports and cables. And I was still trying to sneak a little creativity in. I'd interview activists, or I'd interview for reports people that I thought were interesting, or, but I really wasn't you know, I wasn't doing the creative writing. I wrote so much poetry when I was younger. I'd stopped doing that for years. And so I think this stuff really gave me like permission to find that inner child again and to like embrace it and just let it out. And that has been such a gift.
I'm so much happier. Yeah.
With that in my life. So yeah, in that way it's been really positive. And I mean, I do think I'm a spiritual person now where I really wasn't like, I don't go to like a church, but I do pray like every night. And I'd love like gospel music. I listen to gospel music sometimes because it does remind me of those positive things about that Christian, you know, upbringing or like, yeah. So I do think it's there in my life in a way that it wouldn't have been if I hadn't kind of gone onto the, what I call the recovery woo-woo. The recovery woo-woo path led me back to Jesus.
Yeah. It is funny how like, our culture kind of wavers back and forth between a doubting faith and a haunted doubt, you know. Like everyone feels the need to justify themselves and their choices. And then at the end of the day, it's kind of like, I mean, the person you have to justify yourself to is you. But we often hear these other people's voices about what we should be and what we should do. And that can be really dangerous because it keeps us from being authentic. And ultimately we're not pursuing truth. We're pursuing what we think other people want of us. And so, yeah, like, I mean, it's funny how like, you know, even saying woo woo and just giving yourself that freedom to experiment is just so important, right? Where you're just like, you know what? If it's working for me, I'm going to keep going until I find what I need to find. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously I think like I have answers for that, but I mean, I'm just like one frail like human, you know what I mean? And that's all that we are. And so this idea, and I'm sure like, you know, this is what you talked about with your childhood, like people just, feel this freedom to just criticize and just be like, I know exactly what you need. And it's like, your life is not really in order here either. Like, so it's really, it's really interesting how, well, one of the two things to take away from it is that your writing allowed you to experiment again. And that seems to go along with recovery woo-woo. But I'm sorry, I'm going to say as much as I can.
I know. I'm like, I one day want to write a book called Recovery Woo-woo, and I'm going to talk about all the ridiculous woo-woo things that I tried.
I could go right along with the 10, you know, the 10, was it the 10 stages of pandemic. Oh man. I think we all, like, I've seen some variations on that, like people doing different, their own versions on like YouTube of that. Yeah, absolutely. And when you talk about the writing thing, I think another really important point that has come out a couple times here is that everything we're talking about, these compounds, is they are not, we often talk about drugs as something miraculous, in all its forms, whether it's, pharmaceuticals or entheogenic. Let me make sure I say that right. Entheogenics and
the entheogens. Entheogens,
excuse me. is that as we look at these things, they're not cure-alls. Like you have to have, you know, you have writing and you have reading, and like everyone has to exercise, everyone has to eat well. And, these are all tools that need to be combined, right? Like a lot of times people are looking for that silver bullet for their problems, and that's not the case.
Yeah. And sometimes you really actually need to solve your problems. Like sometimes your problems are things that you need to actually fix or solve before you can kind of have peace. Like, like not every problem is internal. There's also external problems that we have to take care of. Be they like financial or, you know, toxic people in our lives or these things that we haven't, secrets that we're keeping. So yeah, sometimes you got to fix your problems. You got to find meaning for your life and like do stuff that makes you happy. You need like a sense of community, and then maybe you can add on some entheogens and see how you do.
Yeah. Well, and I think you've mentioned, I think that metaphor of the ski slope is is it Michael Pollan?
Michael Pollan, yeah.
Pollan. Phenomenal, right? It makes sense. But at the end of the day, like, you can have a fresh powder of snow, which is very helpful, but you still have to go out and make new trails.
Yes. Right?
Like, and so just seeing all of this in, I think a lot of times the discussion of drugs lacks context for, like, we just talked about, well, you're either taking drugs or you're not. Well, where you take drugs, how you take drugs, mm-hmm. what drugs you are taking, what life circumstances are you struggling? You know, you talked about, do you have suicidal ideation? Do you struggle with domestic abuse? Do you are you bipolar? Like, these are all, like, everything has to be taken within its context. Yeah. And a lot of times we just take it like, oh, like, I mean, the way that I grew up, like, someone was either on drugs or they were not, right? Like yeah. That's all the
this
same
is your
thing.
Brain on drugs.
Yeah. And that's just, at the end of the day, what I really appreciate about this conversation and what you have provided is just a more nuanced discussion to help people understand better what's going on around them, and to better understand our own culture and maybe push forward the conversation a little bit. So I just want to say thank you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And I always tell people, like, I think my novel Cactus Friends, A Psychedelic Love Story by Charlotte Dune, it's a great and gentle entry point into this world of ceremonial medicine and, like, the spirituality and magic it can kind of hold. And there's many great books, but I think, you know, mine is a fun fiction story. So I recommend people check it out if they want to kind of dip their toe into this world.
And that's, I was just about to say, it's fun to read. Like, I love your style. I haven't been able to finish it. I've just started getting into it, but it's like you said, it's a fun and gentle read. My biggest experience aside from your book is Philip K. Dick's works on drugs, but his works on drugs are considerably darker, but his view of the world is darker in general. So I think it's a good balance. And I would highly recommend you check out Kelly's work as Charlotte Dune. Really fantastic. You have the new mushroom honeymoon coming out.
Yes.
Keep your eye out for that.
Yeah, and that one actually touches on opioid addiction. So in addition to the mushroom honeymoon part, so for people interested in that, and I try to do as much research as I could for that character to kind of give, like, a realistic portrayal of what it might be like to have opioid addiction. So, but yeah, it is also about mushrooms in a ceremonial setting, and should be out in December, barring any, like, election emergencies or something crazy.
That's true.
Pray that that doesn't happen.
So it might actually be out by the time that this comes out. So that'll be, so that'll be really exciting, you know, but again, let's, let's wait and see what happens. It's a very exciting times. So anyways, thank you again. And, I really look forward to, seeing, Mushroom Honeymoon come out.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.